It's the Cory Doctorow podcast. I hope you had a good American Thanksgiving if you are in America and you celebrate Thanksgiving. I am recording one of the last podcasts before the Christmas break here because we're in that time of the year now. I put up the Christmas lights over the weekend and I have just turned in another round of small edits to the Third Little Brother book. My editor read the new draft. If you listen regularly, you'll know that I cut the book from 170 to 140,000 words with the help of Juliet Ullman, an outside editor, and my in-house editor at Tor, Patrick Nielsen Hayden, read it and was very enthusiastic. I will quote his email because it made my morning. This is a way stronger book now. I really, really like it. The pacing really moves now. It's grabby as hell. So that is really exciting. And that book will be out in late 2020, and I'm not quite sure whether I'm allowed to give you the title, so I'm going to hold off, but maybe by next week I'll be able to tell you the title. In the meantime, there is a book I can tell you about whose title I know, which is Posy the Monster Slayer. That's my first picture book. It's out on July the 14th from First Second, another division of Macmillan. I like keeping it in the family there. And today I'm going to read to you another story published by Macmillan, Party Discipline. Party Discipline is a novella set in the world of Walkaway that I wrote while I was on the tour for Walkaway in April 2017. It was published on Tor.com in August 2017, and that's what I'm going to read to you now. It's a nice long novella, so it'll probably take me a couple of weeks to get through, and then we'll see what else I have to read to you. All right then, here we go. With no further ado, Party Discipline, published in August 2017 by Tor.com, written by Cory Doctorow. I don't remember how we decided exactly to throw a communist party. It had been a running joke all through senior year, whenever the obvious divisions between the semi-zotas and the rest of us came too close to the surface at Burbank High. Had fun at Stanford. Come drink with us at the communist parties when you're back on break. The semi-zotas were mostly white, with some Asians, not the brown kind, for spice. The non-zotas were brown and black, and we were on our way out. Out of Burbank High, and out of Burbank, too. Our parents had lucked into lottery tickets, buying houses in Burbank back when they were only ridiculously expensive. Now they were crazy. We'd be the last generation of brown kids to go to Burbank High because the instant we graduated, our parents were going to sell and use the money to go somewhere cheaper, and the leftovers would let us all take a couple of mid-range MOOCs from a Big Ten university to round out our community college distance ed degrees. It was nearly time for finals, May, and it was hot. Over 100 degrees every day, and we were all a little crazy. There were the Romeos and Juliets who were feeling the impending tragedy of their inevitable breakups. The kids who knew that they weren't cut out for university or couldn't afford it, who had no clue what they would do next. The ones who had kept their nose to their screens for 4 years, busting their humps to get top marks, and were just now realizing that none of it mattered for shit. And there was me. I liked to hang out with my bestie, Sherelle, in the back of the portables by the old basketball court, where there was a gap in the CCTV coverage that the school filled with intermittent drone flybys. It was where the vapor kids hung out, but I wasn't one of them. Even decaf crack wasn't my idea of a good time. I just like to be a little off the grid because your business is your business, you know? My cousin got laid off. Sherelle's smart fingernails were infected with ransomware again, refusing to work on payment touchpoints and blinking in seizure time. She was awkwardly trying to patch them, pressing each one's hard reset while tapping her phone to it, but this was a job that really needed a third hand, and since I told her that this was going to happen, I refused to help. So she was sitting against the portable wall with her knees drawn up and her phone balanced on them. Mikhail? No, Antoine, the sheet metal guy. It had been decades since Lockheed Martin left Burbank, but there were still plenty of remnants of its glory days, including all the metal shops that had supplied it. Antoine had worked at three or four of these, hopping around as they got shut down, and then he'd got a job in Encino that meant a long commute, but was supposed to be a steady check. That job seemed too good to be true. Turns out that they had a 5-year tax holiday from Encino and it ran out this year. If Antoine had been smart enough to look it up, he'd have known that they weren't going to last past July. She got one fingernail done and moved on to the next one. What's happened to the factory? She got another fingernail done, then dropped her phone. Fucky darn. I kicked it back to her. Thanks. I think, she wedged the phone again and tried to reset her third nail, that they're doing an up and out. That was when a company's tax incentives ran out, and then the company ran out too. shutting down an arm's-length subsidiary through a fast bankruptcy and leaving its creditors, the people who work there, say, to sort out the sale of its assets. Up and outs made sense because the companies were hollow. They leased everything and contracted everything out. The leasing companies didn't beef because they had a sweet loophole. They could take a write-off on the equipment that was based on the full replacement value, despite having already taken depreciation and fees for the whole time the plant had run. We'd done a civics for business unit on it as part of the curriculum on generally accepted accounting principles. Of course, the people who worked there often found themselves shit out of luck when it came to their last paycheck, and sometimes that leased equipment would walk out the door in the days running up to the up and out. I was hungry, like always. Mom didn't believe in scop, and I didn't want to piss her off, so I wouldn't eat out of the vending machines at school. But that meant that if I didn't remember to throw an apple in my bag, my stomach would growl all the way to lunch. Got anything to eat? She finished the fifth nail on her left hand and fished in her purse and passed me some leptin gum, which was supposed to enhance satiety and help people like Sherelle stick to the diets they had no need to be on in the first place. I didn't like to chew it, but my stomach was rumbling. I unwrapped a stick and chewed it. It tasted like caramelized heme proteins, which is to say, cooked blood, in a good way, like a burger, thanks to the transgenic yeast that it was cultured with. My stomach stopped making noise. Maybe it worked, and maybe it was the placebo effect. You sure about that up and out? I tried not to sound too interested. Sherelle had a severe case of risk aversion. Girl, her side eye could cut at 1,000 yards, but I'd been immune to it since the 9th grade. Come on, Sherelle, just asking. It's a daydream. Communist parties were one of my favorite daydreams to dream. Me and my revolutionary comrades and our funny Karl Marx beards, liberating a whole factory under the noses of the cops in the town, running all those machines and giving away free shit until the feedstock ran out. My dream parties didn't usually take place in a sheet metal factory. I liked the idea of taking over a scop factory where they made burgers or candy or ice cream, because then I was the one who gave everyone free candy or burgers or ice cream. But I'd take sheet metal if it was the only thing going. I could learn my skills there. And also, Mama wouldn't kill me for the scop thing if she found out. Damned health food crazies. Lene. She sounded like her own mama when she warned, but I wasn't scared of her mama. I was scared of my mama, and her mama sounded nothing like mine. Really, the whole basis for our lasting friendship was my immunity to all her secret weapons, which would otherwise burn you down in your shoes the first time she spatted with you. It's a daydream. Like saying it twice would make it more believable. You're going to ask someone else if I don't tell you, aren't you? I didn't deign to answer. I'll hold your phone while you do your other hand. She tried her side eye again, then she put it away and patted the ground next to her. Hold my phone then, go on. Once she'd done her right thumb, she said, It's an up and out, yeah, and a lot of the workers aren't happy about it. Wages have been really delayed lately. Lots of people owed a lot of back pay. Especially the people who are out on sick pay, people who got injured on the job, can't go down to the payroll office in person. So there's talk. Talk? She shook her head. You're going to make me spell it out? Talk. They're going to run some shifts after the place shuts down. Sell things at the back door, whatever they can, make back the money they know they're going to be burned for. In case you don't understand, Missy, that means no communist parties. I sighed and moved her phone to the last finger. No party, then. Nope. Forget it, girl. Concentrate on graduating. B students don't get scholarships. It was a running joke between us because A students didn't get scholarships either. I mean, they did, but at a rate that you'd have to be nuts to count on, like basing your life plan on winning the lottery every 10 years. Because there were way, way more kids with broke-ass parents and sharp minds than there were spaces left behind by the dullards who made it into the university on merit and by ticking the no assistance required box on their applications. I was an A student anyway. She called me that night, after Mama's lights out, no phones, blackout time. My little sister Tisha stared at me from her bed when I took the call and mouthed, I'm telling. I rolled my eyes at her. She wouldn't tell. Tisha was still developing her low cunning, and there was plenty of stuff I'd caught her in that she didn't want me blabbing to Mama in retaliation. It's late, I whispered. Your mama's crazy. Sherelle's mama was strict too, but not about bedtimes. She was an insomniac, and so were her kids, and she taught them her coping skills of doing all their homework, showering, laying out their clothes, and packing their lunches at 2 a.m. so they could rise 20 minutes before first bell, pee and wash their faces, and be on campus with seconds to spare. "You call me up after curfew to tell me that? Send a text next time." "Antoine called us all. Thought you'd like to know." I almost said, "Who's Antoine?" And then I remembered. Her cousin, the sheet metal worker. "Oh. You want to know what he said?" "Don't play games, Sherelle. I'm not trying to wake up my mama." Tisha's staring at me like she caught me strangling a cat, too. "Hi, Tisha!" It was loud enough that Tisha heard it through the earpiece. I winced. "Hi, Sherelle," she mouthed and grinned. "She says hi. Now, what is it, Sherelle?" "Antoine called. You said that. He said the reason the plant is shutting down so fast isn't just about the tax credit. He said there was a wobbly in the shop, someone trying to get everyone to sign a union card. Union organizing was a fireable offense, had been since I was a little girl, but that didn't mean it didn't happen. And if enough workers signed the card, the factory wouldn't be allowed to stop paying taxes until the California Labor Board completed its investigation. Antoine says the other workers are pissed." "At the wobbly?" "No, stupid, at the bosses. Antoine says that before all this, most of the employees didn't really give a damn about the wobbly and her nonsense. But now it's got everyone thinking. Got them thinking about making an example out of the plant. They get away with this, next time it'll be even worse." "Hold up, get away with what?" "Just listen, okay?" I realized she was excited, really excited. "The wobbly got deported. Born in America and everything. They sent her to Guatemala. Said her parents were undocumented when she was born here, so that makes her an anchor baby. Everybody is pissed, like I said. They know it's just bullshit. An excuse to get rid of her because she'd come sniffing around the shop. Antoine says none of them gave a damn when she was talking about helping them, but when she got deported for trying, out comes all this corny talk about it being un-American to shut her down." "They're gonna let us have a communist party?" She made a sound between a squeal and a cheer, and Tisha's eyes got wide. I cut her my sternest look so she didn't jump right out of bed and tell Mama what she just heard, and I realized with a sinking feeling that I was going to have to get my little sister involved if I didn't want her to rat me out. Mama would kill me. The gravity of it fell down on top of me. It was one thing to daydream about this, another to plan it. I'd have to do a lot of Googling, using one of those darknet Googles that I couldn't even remember how to reach, which meant that they'd know I was looking up something forbidden, and that meant I'd be even more exposed and... "You aren't even listening to me, are you, Lene?" "Nuh-uh. Sorry, Sherelle. Just thinking it through." "Damn! Are we really going to..." "We are. You don't get us caught first." Antoine met us at a froyo place off San Fernando, the sketchy part near the dead IKEA that had been all cut up for little market stalls that were mostly empty. I hadn't seen him since we'd been freshmen and he'd been a senior, and in the years since he got strangely grayish, his skin sagging off his face and his hair shot with white, like he was an old man. He looked like he hadn't been sleeping much either. He made a sign at us, a thing with his hands like the kids had done to pass messages around the classroom back when we'd been kids. It took me a second to remember what this one meant. "Phones down, school cops coming." I couldn't figure out what that was supposed to mean, but Sherelle got it and reached into her purse to shut her phone down. Now I got it and did the same. We'd both been infected before, of course, drive-by badware that let some creepy rando spy on us through our phones, but then we got more careful. But he wasn't worried about randos spying through our phones. He was worried about cops. "You think Burbank PD is going to bother with you?" I wanted to ask, but fact was, maybe they would. Why not? Once they bought that kind of thing, why wouldn't they want to use it every chance they got? I probably would. "Damn." He looked us up and down, not like a perv, but like a grown-up judging a little kid. "You two are so young. I don't know if this is such a good idea." Sherelle gave him an up and down of her own. "Antoine, we're only 5 years older than you, fool. Smart, too. Besides, it was Lene's idea, not yours." That was news to me. Far as I knew, he'd had the idea, told Sherelle, and she'd said, "Oh, Lene said the same thing." But the way he shook his head, I knew it was true. He'd got the idea from me. That made me feel pretty badass, tell the truth. "Okay, okay, your mama'll kill me, though." "Antoine!" "Okay. There's," he lowered his voice, 45 of us. "And one guy, he says he spoke to a wobbly. They're pissed about what happened to that girl, and they say they'll help. We got all skills and hands we need to get it running, but we don't know how we get the word out without getting popped. Who do you want to reach? I've been wondering about this myself. I didn't really know much about sheet metal, except it was, you know, metal that came in sheets. What would you do with a bunch of that stuff around the house? We don't know either. Antoine looked anxious, more anxious. He dry washed those big knuckled hands. We can make just about anything we got a file for, and there's plenty of files out there. You want a fireplace surround or a new truck bumper? We got you covered. Don't know many people who need a truck bumper, Sherelle said. I know. Antoine gave her a shut-up look that was brotherly, reminding me that they'd been close since they were little. There's all kinds of toys we can make, too, little cars and shit. He looked at us like, you think that's gonna do it? I don't think we're going to strike terror into the hearts of the investor class by giving away little cars, Antoine. Sorry. Because that was the point, right? Give us all heart, give them sorrows? I hadn't really thought about where sheet metal fit into that framework. He shook his head. He knew it, too. What were you making? Uber parts, he shrugged. Mostly for the vans, you know. L.A. Metro had been using the vans for most of my life, though I could still remember when there had been city buses, before the contract went out to Uber. The vans were boxy and indestructible, covered in some kind of slippery treatment that you couldn't write on or mark, and which gave off a funky, musty smell like old socks when the sun baked it. I watched the people mill around the hawker's stalls, smelling the Korean tacos and the pupusas cooking, and wondering whether any of it was real food instead of scop. I'd skipped breakfast that morning and I was hungry. The food was probably scop, judging from the clientele, who were mostly homeless, and Mama wouldn't approve, so I didn't eat, although my stomach growled. According to my science teachers, single-celled organic protein was safe and healthy. According to Mama, it was a large-scale experiment in feeding mutated bacteria to humans. Mama liked to point out that rich people didn't eat scop. They didn't drink coffee either, but that never stopped Mama. She had a lapel pin that read, "A foolish consistency is the hobgoblin of little minds." Mama was one of a kind. The homeless were accompanied by their inevitable companions, the lovingly tended, rusting, ancient shopping carts. It had been years since it was possible to remove a shopping cart from a grocery store without being caught, but the number of people who used the carts as home, locker, and pack mule had only grown in the years since, creating fierce competition for the old, dumb carts. These ones looked particularly raggy. Antoine and Sherelle kept talking while I stared at the carts, but eventually they followed my stare. I looked at them, and they looked back at me. "Those would be easy," Antoine sounded dismissive. "So," Sherelle said, "you want to make something hard or something useful?" I put my hand on his shoulder. "Antoine, you make those, you'd be making something that everyone will see every day for years and years to come." His eyes glinted. "Yeah, yeah." He looked at the sky for a minute. "I bet there's all kinds of ways we can improve them, too. Bet there's designs for better ones like crazy from the refugee camps. I know I saw them in a news clip or something. That's amazing." He grinned, and he was as handsome as he'd been when I was a freshman, and he was captain of the senior swim team. I told myself that the flip-flops in my stomach were hunger, not crushing. It was only 5 minutes before the final bell when the school went on lockdown. We all groaned as our homeroom teacher, Mr. Pitsikian, sprinted to the classroom door and swung down the bar, slapping the button that polarized the classroom windows, including the little one in the door itself, plunging the room into darkness. The groan made Pitsikian glare at us with a finger on his lips. Rule number one in lockdown, no words. Rule two, silently build a shelter of bullet-absorbing furniture and then hunker down. Nearly everything in the classroom was made out of wax cardboard that wasn't about to stop any artillery. Not even crossbows. Yeah, some fools actually went on school shootings armed with crossbows. But the room had once been a science lab, and there was one big workbench running the length of the wall, made of steel and concrete, with long plugged hookups for burners along its length. Previous lockdown drills had established that this was our designated shelter, so we shuffled behind it. It's not that we weren't worried about getting shot, but we also knew that lockdowns were, 9 times out of 10, hoaxes. Some fool sent a text that said, "Gonna be at school later," and it got auto-corrected to, "Guns be at school later," and that tripped Burbank SWAT's paranoid fusion center security AI, and then we all had to hide behind the lab bench for half an hour while the toy soldier squad did a sweep of the school. We hunkered down and texted each other. The school deactivated its network filters during lockdown so we could text status updates to the cops or our last words to our loved ones. And we made dumb jokes. Our messages were interrupted every 30 seconds by reminders to stay silent and vigilant, broadcast on the school's administrative emergency channel by the school safety office. On top of that, there were actual status updates. Officers en route. Officers on site. North wing sweep complete. South wing sweep complete. Portable sweep complete. More of this. Then, all clear, all clear, all clear. Followed by an announcement out of every phone speaker in the room. Only phones that ran the school safety app would work on school property, so we all ran it, but dang, it was some creepy shit. I left the classroom thinking about my homework and whether I was supposed to pick up Tisha from band practice, and I was so lost in my thoughts that I didn't notice the guy in the suit until he put a hand on my shoulder just as I was heading for my locker. Lene Walker, just the way he said it, gave him away as a cop. I felt my heart rate triple. Yes? Please come with me. He steered me to the administrative office. The secretary on the front desk pointedly didn't stare at me as he led me into one of the VP's offices. The first thing I noticed was my backpack on the desk, surrounded by its contents, and next to it, Sherelle's bag and its contents too. That was when I noticed Sherelle, sitting on a low sofa. The cop indicated the spot next to her with a tilt of his head, and I sat. The late afternoon sun slanting through the window caught the huge fart of dusty air that escaped from its cushions when I settled in. Sherelle coughed a little and caught my eye. She looked scared. Really scared. All right, then. I'll talk to you next week. Have a great week back. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Cory Doctorow Podcast, licensed under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-alike US 3.0. Or as Woody Guthrie put it in another context, this song is copyrighted in the US under Seal of Copyright 154085 for a period of 28 years, and anyone caught singing it without our permission will be a mighty good friend of ourn, because we don't give a dern. Publish it, write it, sing it, swing to it, yodel it, we wrote it, that's all we wanted to do. Many thanks to John Taylor Williams for mastering. That's Ryneck Studio, W-R-Y-N-E-C-K Studio, @gmail.com. John Taylor Williams is a full-time, self-employed audio engineer, producer, composer, and sound designer. In his free time, he makes beer, jewelry, odd musical instruments, and furniture. He likes to meditate, to read, and to cook. Talk to you next week.